Say What? Say What radio show. With no agenda. It's always a surprise. But if we're not having fun, we're doing something wrong.
Welcome to the Say What special continuing series on woo-woo reality that will eventually be made into a book. My name is Nancy Hopkins. It is February 18, 2026. Wow. You know, doing this project, I have to think back about time. When did that happen? And it is a very interesting, let's say, overview of time. Time is first off, you know, scientifically, it doesn't exist. We're traveling through space, and we have an artificial time that says this is 24 hours, this is a week, this is a month, this is a year. So this has been on my mind. How do I explain all this? How do I get it out there where it's understandable? So what I decided to do was to just sit down and write a little bit to try to get it together. So right now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read what I wrote, just like I wrote it, so that we can at least start this conversation, because understanding timelines, hey, I mentioned them in the some, you know, when I was talking about the Vincent and the whole thing with this, you know, psionics warfare, and I was talking about timelines, but I didn't know anything about that when it happened. It took decades later before I understood exactly what had happened regarding timelines. However, it was a long journey, and I'm just going to start reading what I wrote. Woo-woo experiences can be your own, or they can be those of other people who talk or write about them. So anyone taking this journey with me are experiencing woo-woo reality. For me, one of the most transforming stories was Anastasi's life, presented in a series of books by Vladimir Megre. I don't know how to pronounce his name. It's Megre. And they're found under the term The Ringing Cedars of Russia. It's a series, I think there's nine books. It is an amazing revelation of what is and what is possible. The one thing that stood out was Anastasi's revelation that this journey to enlightenment that we're on has happened repeatedly over time. Most ended just before the key to enlightenment was fully understood. But this time, Anastasia says something happened in 2000 that finally changed the ending. She never explained what the magical event was that gave us a chance to change everything. What I think happened this time, volunteers came to Earth in waves of spiritually evolved souls who were born into the human form. In the last week of 2000, these volunteers became warriors. They jumped timelines. Each has a mission. Mine was to be aware of what had happened so I could play the storyteller. The story begins with the burning of a wooden carving with a set of talons on top of a circle. I thought it was a bird perched on top of the world. As time went by, I realized it was not a bird and it was not perched. It was the enemy controlling the world. The next thing was the voice asking me to jump timelines. First question, why did I listen? Well, why did I listen? And I'm coming off of the text now. Because this voice that is from the Galactic Federation, it actually had kind of been the voice that guided me to certain things. And that'd be a book in itself, how many guidances I've gotten just in finding out things, researching. It never took me down a dead end road. As far as I know, it's never lied to me. But the thing that kind of made me so comfortable with it was the frequency. I would hear the voice, but then when I focused on what's happening, I would realize that it was a transmission and it was coming through my right forehead, right side of my head. It was always exactly in the same space that I would feel this energetic situation. And it asked me a question. It had been telling me to do things. It would ask me questions or help me formulate questions. And then miraculously, I'd find some book, some TV show, something that would give me information that allowed me to pursue the truth. Okay. So when they asked me, would I jump timelines? Did I understand what they were asking? No. I didn't know what a timeline was. I had heard of it, but I really didn't have any working understanding of it. So it says to me, will you jump timelines? Well, now, he would have thought that somebody that doesn't know anything about it would have said, what the heck do you mean? But I didn't. The second question is, why did I respond with a question? Will I win? And they confirmed that very rapidly. The third question, and another question for me, is, will I save everyone? There was a hesitation, and they finally said, well, yes. Okay, so why? Why did I do that? I think it's because maybe all my life I felt like I had a mission, a job to do, something important. Yet I can't tell you that I could articulate in any way, shape, or form where that was going. But it was like, yes, I get these signals that are outside of me, but there's a signal that's internal to me. And that's the one that I think of as my soul, my actually soul, my higher self. When I'm doing real kind of creative stuff, it's more like I'm listening to a story and then repeating it. When I ask a question that I Two of them, will I win? Will I save everyone? When I ask those kind of questions, they're really being asked from my higher self, my soul, my deeper being. And I think I told you in the beginning of the book, but maybe not. When I was a freshman in college, it was a very, very difficult transition. And one day I just woke up and I couldn't decide whether to get out of bed. And then when I got out of bed, I couldn't decide what to wear. And then I couldn't decide whether to go to the class or not. And I didn't. I went back to bed. And this went on for 3 days. And then on the third day, I had come far enough down to sort of start to analyze my own, well, why is this happening to me? Well, I was having a nervous breakdown, basically, as a kid. I mean, my mom, my dad, all the family, the house, the neighbors, everything was different. And now I'm in an environment that I was not comfortable in. And I was doing, I was going to be a phys ed teacher, so I took phys ed, not realizing that I would have to demonstrate gymnastics. We had never had gymnastics. The rest of the stuff, I mean, like tumbling, and none of that. The only kind of sports that we had growing up was baseball or softball and basketball. We didn't even have football. So I was really, really struggling because not only did I have to worry about the academic aspects of it, but I had to learn gymnastics. I mean, it was like, okay, but I was not happy about it. And that was weighing on me. So, like I said, I was having like a nervous breakdown. On that third day when I got up, I really had come to a point to say, all right, you got all this stuff happening to you, but what's thrown you into this funk? And oddly enough, it was not the stress of what I just told you. It was a realization that the reality that I had been living in was no longer the reality I was living in. So I started looking at it and I realized that my studies in JFK had led me to a place where I really didn't like the reality that was being presented. It was violent. It was power hunger. It was a bunch of insane people running the world. Because that's what the Kennedy assassination did to a generation. And I realized that I didn't have a good grasp of reality. So what I did was I sort of started, I always talked to myself, being, in a family of 10, you got to talk to yourself or else you're just going to lose yourself. And I said, I don't know what real is. So I'm going to assume that nothing and everything is real. I'm not going to believe that what I knew is what is. And I'm going to question everything that's new to see if it makes any damn sense to myself. I had come to the realization that the only person that I trusted was my higher self. Now, at the time, I didn't think of it that way, but I definitely felt that my best friend was me. And why not? Everything you experience, everything you know, everything you think about, every person, everything in your life. The only person that knows that is you. So if you can't talk to yourself, if you can't make yourself your own best friend, it's going to be a long and lonely road. And thank God that I was led to that realization. So, what happened in the timeline changed? Because that it definitely changed. It was December, last week in December of 2000. I said, oh, okay, yeah, we'll jump timelines, having no idea what it meant. Well, let me tell you what happened after that. The job at Parker Plaza had gotten very funky. I'm not going to get into all of what it was, but let's put it this way. After I left the job, the board of directors, the two managers, there was two during the time frame that this happened, and my boss, who was also my friend, were all arrested and brought up on charges of stealing over $3 million from the condominium. That happened after I left. Don't know, maybe 6 months. But the reason that I left was because I felt I had to. And I wasn't thinking about timeline shifts. I'd kind of put that in the past and didn't even think about it. Excuse me. But what was happening is that everything about the Wilder Yard started unraveling. All of the people who had come there, been friends, felt like family, they all sort of left. Now, a good portion of them went up to South Carolina, North Carolina. I'm not even sure where, up in the Carolinas. It was weird. Like everybody left Miami and went to the Carolinas. A vast amount of them. The only person who ended up staying with me and is still stays with me is Peter. Everybody else went off, and I'm gonna maybe talk about some of the people. I don't know. I'm not gonna think about that right now because we're talking about what really happened in 2001. So I said that, I've always been able to make money, even though I didn't make enough money at Parker Plaza. And this job I was doing, the side job, was to do resumes for people. And one day I'm home and my partner calls me and says, hey, can you write about an M203 grenade launcher? This guy just called me and he needs somebody that will put together a training manual. I started laughing. I thought, what the hell is he talking about? The M203 is a grenade launcher that attaches to a rifle. And yes, I was familiar with it because I was a trained military person. And although I never shot it, because the grenade that they'd shoot was, well, $100. So, but somebody in your group would shoot it and you'd watch it and everything. But I was familiar with it. And it turned out he wasn't just, making a joke or something. This guy had called him. To make a long story short, I ended up going down there, writing that book and writing another one and da-da-da-da-da. And every time I'd end a project, they had another one until the office manager actually left the job and I got the office management job. All right, that all happened in the first part of 2001. I mean, it was just crazy. So I could afford getting the office manager job and had to quit the Parker Plaza job because these piecemeal things I could do because I didn't get much sleep, but that was because I was going out and seeing the sunrise every day. 5,000 times, I figure. And I was beating off to the sun, but that's another story. I didn't realize that at the time either. But I could get a lot of things done, including working two jobs, but not one where I've got to be there for 8 hours during the day. And I actually knew nothing about anything regarding the office management. So I had to throw a lot of effort into understanding not just how the office operated, but how they sold things. I became the shipping manager. I had to figure out all sorts of crazy, crazy stuff. And I had to understand about metal. What's metal? Why do I have to be so specific on the aluminum, the type of aluminum that go in, all these technical questions about the business. So I was not thinking timelines. I was not researching metaphysics. I wasn't thinking about talking to my higher self. I was trying to get this job so that I felt comfortable and I knew what I was doing. And that's what happened. I just kind of like dove into it, and it took probably 2 years. Maybe not, because time was running really fast. Okay. But it was, I kept saying to myself, why am I doing this? Why am I doing this? This is a crazy ass job. Well, what happened was that, yes, we were very busy. Yes, we were selling a lot of these things. And I ended up working there for 10 years. I'm going to tell you why this is important in a second. So we come up on every morning when I would get up, I would turn on the television and listen to Good Morning America just to get the news and find out what was happening. Because I didn't have to be into the office until 10, thank God. So I'm listening to it. It's actually, they've already signed off. And I'm getting, the coffee ready and getting dressed and doing all this stuff. So I'm not sitting there looking at it. I'm just listening to it. And all of a sudden their voices are back on. And they're talking about some fire. And I don't know, what are they talking about? So I stop and I look. And there's a picture of some tower that was on fire. I had no idea about these twin tower things. Nothing, nothing. Never heard of them. And yet they seem to think that I should know about them because they're so important for the city of New York. Well, okay. Well, that was, of course, September 11th. And I don't even, I think I was late going to work. I mean, well, probably. All I can remember is what I was seeing and about the story, about what was going on. I know I ended up going to work later in the day, but I'm not sure I was on time at all. So I see this thing happen, or it's playing, and the fires are now it's obvious this is a big fire in this tower thing. And then I see this, it looks like an aircraft coming into the picture on the TV. And I thought, are they going to try to drop water or something? What is this about? And of course, that was the second plane. The amount of shock that I was going through, and I'm just telling you my experience. I mean, everybody was going through this. It was like, it was unreal. It was totally unreal. And for those people that, and so many of you don't know what I'm talking about, except that you might have heard about it, the people that were there, they'll never forget this. Everything that I'm saying to them, they can vividly remember. So, like I say, I finally did get to the office. And as soon as I got there, I turned on the computer and I Googled. Well, I don't even, yeah, I think Google was up then, maybe not, but I Googled the search. I did a search. And there was already an engineer who was coming out saying that the tower, something else had happened to the towers. There's no way they could have fallen like that. And he had already got this thing up on YouTube. It was a picture of a silo that was being destroyed. And it looked just like the towers falling. He was absolutely convinced it was a controlled demolition. An hour later, maybe two, I don't know, my boss comes in and he's like frazzled, like everybody else was. And he says, and I said to him, they took it down. Somebody destroyed that, the Twin Towers. They took them down by demolition. And he said, what are you talking about? I'm saying, I saw this video. Let me pull it up. It had already been taken down off of YouTube. But, and for all I know, I'm the only one that saw it. Sometimes I think they do these things so that I'm the only one that sees it, so I get the information. But I had the information. And nor did I ever see it again, even though I looked for it. So I had the information. It came down by demolition, planned demolition. Now, I'm a military person. I think like this. I know a lot about a lot of war stuff. It did, it made sense to me that there would have been a demolition system in the buildings because of the attack on the buildings. I think it was almost a decade before this, where they set off a bomb in a truck, and if that truck had been 50 feet closer to the interior of where the everything was standing on top of these big, huge pillars. I mean, they were 4 feet deep. Yeah, I don't know, more than 4 feet. I don't know, remember all the details, but it could have come down. So it made sense to me that this building, that these buildings that were in the middle of Manhattan, in the middle of the financial buildings of the world, would have such a system in case they were attacked again. Because if the original attack had worked, it would have essentially broken the bottom part of this tower, and the tower would have crashed. It wouldn't have fallen apart. It would have crashed. So to keep it from crashing and destroying everything, I think that there was a demolition system put in. Now, I held with that belief. And everything now, thank God I was sort of semi able to do what I needed to do in the office by what I had learned, because my whole life became one of finding out what happened on that day. With the same focus, the same dedication that I brought to the JFK assassination, I'm on the trail of what the hell happened. And I spent an enormous amount, every book that came out, I read. I would everything, anything. I mean, I probably knew more about other people's looks at it and what they were saying and trying to get to the real facts and stuff than almost anyone, because my life allowed it. Not only could I live by myself, I could focus on this, it could become my life, but I was in a job that allowed me, oddly enough, to have a lot of time on the internet talking to people on YouTube and Facebook and other places, learning things, learning, learning, learning. And finally, I knew what it was. I knew what had happened. And yet I didn't exactly know what to do with it. But it did kind of, let's say, fade out a little bit for 10 years, as a matter of fact. Then it was the 10th anniversary of the 9/11. And because it was the anniversary, the UPS guy would come in almost every day and take a break at my place. He'd just sit down and we'd just chat. And the subject of 9/11 came up. And I started telling him my theory. And as happened every time I tried to tell somebody my theory, he got this glassy eyes and he said, "Well, I gotta go." And he gets up and he walks out the door. And I'm sitting there and I'm going like, "This sucks." Every time I try to tell somebody something they don't want to hear, that happens. And I said to myself, what would happen if you were in a car and you were traveling a long distance and you had one person who believed in the narrative and somebody else that knew the truth? And you couldn't, the person that believed the narrative couldn't get out of the car. They had to listen. What would happen? And I just kind of threw that into my head. Well, the next thing I know, and this was like I say, it was 10 years after the event. The 10 years after the event, I had absolutely learned everything I could learn about the business. All the files had been refiled so that, yeah, I mean, everything was done. And then we weren't getting any orders. And we had an immense number of overseas, most of our sales were overseas. So, but nobody was buying weapons, especially ours. So I had a real lot of time that I didn't have to do anything for the business. But I had a very, very astute boss. And so I just started to write a book. If I, with the premise that it's a fictional book, I tell them in the, you know, this is fact-based fiction, fact-based fiction. Because everything I was going to tell them, I already, this is the facts, this is how it happened. But now I decided I was going to put it into the mouths of fictional characters to tell the story. You know, get somebody that's locked in a car and can't leave. So I start writing this book. Now, this is where the higher self, soul, whatever, you know, really started talking to me because it's fiction. We're creating it out of nothing, but I also know the facts that I need to cover. So I would go through my head, figure out a scenario. Do different scenarios. And then I'd go to the office and I'd take care of a few things and I'd sit down and I'd start to basically transcribe. I was hearing stories. And I'd just sit there and it would just flow out and, you know, here's another part of the story. It was very, very easy to write and it was a lot of fun. So this quality, this feeling of being, having somebody tell you a story was one that I developed when I had a paper route when I was 10 years old. And it was, took me an hour and a half to do it. During that time, I would, because I was, mom made us read. During that time, I would make up stories. I thought I was making up stories, but I think it was my higher self working with me to develop this ability to be a good storyteller. So when I was writing the 9/11, again, it was 9/11 Crusade is what the title became. When I was writing it, I was very comfortable with the process because I had done it when I was a young kid, even when I was in college. And I had to walk long distances. I'd do the same thing. I would write stories in my head. So, you know, I'm writing the book. It takes, I don't know, I really don't have any concept. Maybe, I don't know. I have no idea of how long it took. But it just came together. And I was getting paid to sit in the office anyway. And I wrote this book. And the boss would come in. He comes in the door right behind me. You can see what the screen says. So okay. So that was of course 2011 that all this is happening. That I'm writing the book. And I get the book finished. Well, what happened is I go in and I sit down and I said, okay, so where do we go now? Oh, in the end, the book's ended. I said, what? What do you mean it's ended? It's ended. You can write another one. You told them you would tell them what happened on 9/11. You've done that. Write another one, but not this one. And it ended. So I had to figure out, how do I get this thing published? I had to stop the recording to check when I actually published the book, and it was 2010. So obviously, the conversation I had with the UPS guy wasn't predicated on the anniversary of the thing, but it was 2010. So I did. I figured out how I could get this published on Amazon and blah, 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 and published the book. Well, what happened after that was, oh, to be honest with you, it was just a real mind bender because I had been doing not just the 9/11 research, but like I say, I was on Facebook. So another year goes by, and well, it was about 2010, but it was more like 2011. I don't know exactly when. And I come across this, it was Carrie Cassidy. One of her podcasts was out there. And it was an interview with a guy by the name of Bill Brockbrader. Now, he went under an assumed name at the time. But this guy sat there with her and started telling stories that sort of confirmed stories that I had heard, but didn't think there was enough proof about them to say, oh, yeah, that's the way it is. I'm very selective in what I actually think is true. I have to have at least three different sources for the same story before I'll even consider it true. But then I keep looking at it because I'm not here to prove that I know everything. The only thing I'm concerned about is knowing the truth. So if I believe something and then find something that makes me think, no, this isn't, I will look at it from a lot of angles before I say, no, it isn't, or it is. But if I don't find that it is true, I'll come out and say, well, I was wrong about that one. So I'm not engaged in, any kind of a narrative. I'm just following the, trying to find out what's real. So Bill Brockbrader comes out and he's talking about timelines. He's talking about devices that can see into the future. He's talking about computer systems that you can say, all right, if we do this, this, and this, what will happen? And the computer can generate the probable outcome of whatever it is you decide to do. At the same time that this particular podcast came out, everybody began to get focused on 2012. because of a Hopi prophecy that 2012 was the end of an age. And there were some of them were freaking out. It was just really insane. Hopi shamans were visiting the United States and talking to different people about this, and oh, the end time, it's going to be 2012. Well, I started to, because of what things Brock Brader was saying, I started to really turn and look at the timeline thing. And trust me, I really didn't remember. I mean, I remembered probably, but there was no necessity to recall it. So I didn't think about the fact that I had said I jumped timelines. I just, now it was coming out all over the place because of this 2012 thing. So I began to, let's say, learn about timelines and to also accept that they're real. And to begin to analyze changes in reality that I would see that indicated, well, maybe we just had another timeline change, because it also became very apparent that timelines are the best. Okay, we talked about the tapestry of life as we started out this book. And you've got these threads that are taking you down certain educational roads, let's put it that way. Well, the same thing sort of is the same visualization when you think in terms of timelines. Remember that there's reality is what we think it is, and majority wins. Now, what does that mean? Well, whatever you're looking at reality different than anybody else. You're one special, unique being, and you're seeing and you're interpreting. That's all one person. But if that one person begins to think in terms of what's real as this, that, and the other thing, and there are other people that say, well, I think that's real too. Well, that develops like a thread, like a timeline. These different threads come together. And now, well, let me put it to you this way. These different strings come together, and then you've got like a thread all wound in together. That's a timeline that a bunch of people have agreed to is existing. Well, there's so many unique timelines that all are basically telling the same story, just in different ways, maybe, but it's all, how do I put it? It's like we're all working in this big, agreement as to what's reality, which in many cases is not what anybody thinks. So it can get really murky. But there is this, somebody's writing a story, and it's a book. And we're just chapters in the book. The way that we exist is just piecemeal, all together, we're creating all of this. But how do they come together? How do they work together? Well, like I say, you end up with these timelines that are agreements by certain people as to what's real. But these various timelines are almost then woven into some kind of a rope, and so you have different versions of timelines all contained within the parameters of this rope. So we get to 2012, and by this time I'm getting a real feeling for what timelines are. And when I looked at what was really happening, I could feel that there were basically only two timelines that were engaged, were existing, because I might decide to go to the right instead of the left. Well, once I do that, my focus is taken to the right, not the left. So the timeline that on that left that would have taken me someplace else doesn't have the energy because I'm focused on the right. And they kind of like fade out. All right. So any given timeline can shift in an instant. And if you're sensitive like I am, and then I found Starfire Tor had some kind of a scientific way of being able to tell you when there's going to be a timeline change and how is it going to affect you. She was very, very accurate, and I have a lot of appreciation for what, let's say, she could bring to the table. So working with what Starfire was saying and being able to feel, yeah, she's right, this is what happened. I became sensitized to the timelines. And it seemed like there was like only two main timelines. The one timeline I call the goody two shoes. Oh, ascension. Everybody's gonna, leave the planet into a higher dimension. I never really got into it. But then there was this other one, doom and destruction, deep state, the swamp, greed, satanic rituals, of crazy, crazy, crazy stuff. I mean, a nasty, nasty place to be. Certainly didn't want to be there. In the meanwhile, I began to follow Bill Brockbrader on Facebook. As a matter of fact, I was one of the first 100 people that got on his Facebook, and this group was amazing. I made so many good friends out of that Facebook group because, and Bill would talk, would be on it and stuff. So we were following Bill Brockbrader's journey. I'm not going to get into the details of it right now. There's important things that he taught me, but right now it was just a way explaining that people were coming together in very, very powerful metaphysical ways. And the Bill Brockbrader Facebook was one of them. There was a guy from England, Maddie, and of course they're 6 to 7 hours ahead of us. And during the day, he would research and post things on Facebook so that when I got to the office, I'd open up the Bill Brockbrader site, and that Maddie had put all this information on it. So I just look at what Maddie said, and he cut down on the research incredible for me because I could look at the important things that were trending at the time, and he was doing the legwork. So I was learning very, very quickly at, this particular working up to 2012. And as we got closer to 2012, I realized that there were only the goody two shoes and this terrible timeline. And I didn't know what to make of it. And then maybe it was Bill, I don't know. Somebody confirmed that that was exactly what was happening. So I'm watching this, and we get into 2012. And on the other side of the holidays, let's say now we're into 2013. I could see that there were those only the only things that existed were those two timelines. And I think what happened is that in our travels through the cosmos, there are certain places that it's like you go through a singularity. It's like a reset of timelines. It's like, okay, let's get rid of all this stuff that's not mattering because these are the two dominant timelines. So I'd been watching these two dominant timelines, and we go through 2012, and sure enough, as soon as we get there, they're there. I don't see any other timelines existing. Initially, that was what I saw, but then I realized, no, there is a third timeline that seems to be like something in the center. Everybody in 2013 was, I got a new mate, I got a baby's coming, I got a new job. It was everybody had all this activity and all this promise of different type of life. And by the time we get to April, All of those things have collapsed and they're not there except this third one, the middle one. And that's the one I felt I was on. It wasn't goody two shoes. It wasn't doom. It was understanding doom and knowing that we had a mission to clean up the earth. The goody two shoes wanted to move out of the house, the dirty house, the filthy house, move on without cleaning. And I couldn't do that. It was like, no, we can't do that. We have to solve the problem with Earth here. And that was the timeline that for me was the dominant timeline. That's what I was on. So this is, like I say, working up to 10, to 2012. So we get to 2012, and like I say, nothing. We went through the singularity. There was two timelines, and then all of a sudden, I see this third timeline, and boom, we're on our way to 2013. The next big thing that happened was 2013. The 9/11 Crusade book was out there, but it wasn't selling. I mean, it was on Amazon, but it really wasn't selling. But I had done my job. I wrote the damn thing. It was there. It was there. So we get to 2013, and it was May or March. I don't know. Those two kind of get to. But it was springtime. We go into work, and the boss says, "We're closed. We're out of business." All of a sudden, boom. And I had asked him a few months before that if we were business-wise in trouble. He said, no. Yeah. So all of a sudden, I'm 63 years old, and I don't have a job. I have been very sympathetic with people that this sort of thing happened to. I never imagined it happening to me. I couldn't find a job, even part-time jobs. I mean, nothing was coming through. Thank God a friend of mine gave me enough money to get through, at least the first month. And then, my father lent me money to get me past June because I tried to get a job. Nobody wanted to talk to somebody my age, no matter how much experience I had. So the reason June became critical was because I could get on Social Security at 63. Now, if you do it at 63 and not 66, you make a lot less than if you wait the other 3 years. But I didn't have any options. So I said, no, we got to do this. At least I'll, have money coming in. So that happens. I sign up for it, but I got to wait until like 3 months to get the money. So my dad lent me money, $5,000 to just get me through that time period. So I get through the time period, and I had been very frugal with the money. They paid me for the months that I think it was 3 months that took to wait to get approved. And I had enough money to be able to pay my father back. So I call him and I said, "Dad, I've got the money I need to give back to you. How do you want me to send it?" My mom had died, I think, about 8 years before this. And he said to me, "I don't feel good." And all the, warning bells went off in me. And so I took, because he had a lot of health issues with his heart and stuff. So I was trying to, what's your symptoms, Dad? What do you want to do? Try to figure it out, help him through it. And my brother Jimmy came in. He lived right next door. So I said, "Please put Jim on the phone." And I told Jimmy what was happening. I said, "You guys have got to handle this. I can't handle it from here." And so he said, yeah, don't worry about it. Well, they didn't worry about it. He refused to go to the hospital and he died. But he left me a sizable, and he had nine kids. Each of us got a lot of money. We had no idea he had as much money as he did. And I, because of that, I would, and the Social Security, I didn't need a job. It was as simple as that. But what had happened is that before Social Security clicked in, and I didn't know what in the hell was going to happen, because the Social Security was not going to bring me enough money. That was obvious. So I get into this incredible funk, and I was so scared. I'd seen people that had families and they couldn't afford the families because they couldn't get a job. I used to feel terrible, but to be in the situation is nothing like I could have imagined. It is awful. Well, I'm really having another n nervous breakdown, but I mean, it was terrible. But I had learned that the only way you get out of these things is to focus on something to get yourself out of it. So I decided that I was going to publish another book. The book had already been written. It's called The John Kennedy Jesus Christ Connection. It tells you exactly what happened with the John Kennedy assassination. And I've not been proven wrong. I've got a lot of more, confirmation since I wrote the book. So I decided to put that together to publish it in Amazon, because the 9/11, I knew the process. And I put it all together and I'm ready to publish it. But then something stopped me and I said to myself, yeah, but I've got all these notes. See, when I would do all this research over the decades, I would keep notes. They were like briefing papers, like I'd learned from the military, how to brief. You take information and you give an overview of it. So I had a lot of notes on this stuff. So I decided, oh, all right, okay, let me look at this stuff. Well, I wrote another book called Down the Rabbit Hole. It was based on these notes, but all I did was go through the notes. I actually did not make any change in the sequencing of the notes. So it took me a summer. And I know this because when I started the project, like I say, it was before the Social Security thing started up. It was summer. I got so into doing this book that became Cosmic Reality that one day I walked outside and I went, why is it cold? I don't know if I've been outside. I mean, I must have gone to the grocery store and that sort of thing, but I was not aware of summer. It came, it went. I had gone from springtime to fall. And everything else had been focused totally on this writing of Cosmic Reality. So I get the Cosmic Reality thing done. I publish it on Amazon. My dad died, left me a lot of money. I was able to pay off the house, and he also had stock options. I sold stock options in order to pay off the house, but one of them I kept, and that was Facebook. And that sucker, kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I never looked at it. I mean, I just, it wasn't my money. It was dad's money. And it was, I needed some money to get out of the problems I was having. But, as far as that went, I just kind of like once a year, the stock guy would call me and we'd have a conversation. So when the Cosmic Reality book got published, and that had to have been 2011, because the actual 10-year event for the assassination of JFK came, and by that time I had ended up with Wolf Spirit Radio. Wolf Spirit Radio was put together by people who we know as super soldiers, people that were trained to do stuff that is sci-fi kind of stuff. They're real. And a group of them independently had started this thing called Internet Radio. It wasn't called podcast. Podcasts, same thing, but that word never came out until probably 10 years later. And they came together under the umbrella of Wolf Spirit Radio because they were being attacked trying to do this individually. So by coming together, they were able to help each other stay online. Well, I had a friend of mine I'd met on the Brock Raider Facebook, and she said to me, would you come on a show with me? And I thought she wanted me to be interviewed because I'd already done one of these things on another station. And that station was Revolution Radio. And it was Dr. Robin, what was Robin's last name? It doesn't matter. Dr. Robin. I mean, it matters, but I'll figure it out for the book. I don't remember it right now. And she was interviewing me about the, I believe it was the 9/11 crusade. Had a really good time with her. So that was my first. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a internet radio. But that's how I got introduced to Revolution Radio, and they were sisters. Wolf Spirit and Revolution were like sisters. They had actually been together, and then I don't know why, but Revolution went off on its own. And one of the people on Wolf Spirit knew about the 9/11 crusade, and also that I had written a second book, and it talked about the John Kennedy assassination. And here we have the, anniversary. So he brings me on the radio. And we do a special show on the anniversary. To this day, it's still a very, very good show. Because it was people, he was a wonderful man, and he was young. Yet he didn't live very long. He had some kind of a medical thing that they took him out right away. And at the time, I wasn't thinking in terms of would they kill somebody that's talking the truth, but now I know they would. I don't know that that was what happened. It could have been he was just had completed his message, his mission. So I do that. And this friend of mine, that's when she said to me, why don't you come over and we'll do a show? I didn't realize that she was meaning that I would join the show. I thought she wanted me on there like a host. So that started me up doing a show, internet radio show. And because I was very, very good at it, I had a great voice. I could talk on any subject. I'm a storyteller. I ended up doing other shows, and I was with JP on two different shows, and he was the producer of these shows. And then the guy who owned Wolf Spirit, Dave Crusoe, he went and died. And JP got Wolf Spirit. He took it over. So I was doing a lot of shows with JP in one way or the other, him producing, or we were doing shows together. And also not just on Wolf Spirit, but also on Revolution Radio. Well, I would begin to learn about internet radio and stuff, and found out that These two shows were being watched live as they were being presented by probably 10,000 people around the world. They were the two biggest shows, biggest places. Very few other people were out there at the time, and these were the biggest. And you people could come in and they could chat while we were doing live shows and stuff. Well, I'm not even going to get into the politics of it, but what happened was that it was a woo-woo event. All right, I guess I better tell you about that because it's a woo-woo event. I was on a Skype. We used Skype at the time. I was on a Skype call with Dolly Howard and why am I having the woman who actually is behind the voicing of the introduction, and what is her name? Can't remember. I will. It's so strange. It's sort of floating in and out, you know. But anyway, she's on the call with me. And those two were very upset about something JP had done. Both different things, but they wanted out. They didn't want to work with him anymore. Well, in the meantime, I had gotten so that I could do what he was doing. And I'm going to tell you about that in a second. But they wanted leave, that Dolly was going to go one way or the other. And the other producer, you know, I mean, I was brand new producing, I could do it, but I wasn't doing it. And she's having problems with him, and all of a sudden she says, "Wait a minute, JP's trying to contact me." And so she does this back and forth with JP, and he was accusing her of sabotaging the radio station or something. It was really bizarre, but it was like he knew what the conversation was, but there's no way he could have. Well, that was when I ended up leaving Wolf Spirit and starting Cosmic Reality, and that was 2016. So we're talking about a period from, you know, essentially 2013 to 2016 that I was on these different shows on Revolution Radio and with JP. Now, what happens that really set the stage for the next, let's say, chapter on woo-woo reality was the fact that I was doing research on electromagnetic pulse. It's a phenomenon when a nuclear bomb goes off, it sends out this electromagnetic pulse that then destroys technology, electronics. And I don't remember exactly why I was looking at it, but you know, like I'm doing all these radio shows, I have to be able to talk about things that are happening at the time. And so I was always looking at other people and getting all this information to be able to do what I did, which was to go on any show and be able to talk about any subject. Because if I don't know anything about something, I know how to ask questions to, you know, have that person tell me. So I was, again, it was a very, very intense learning situation. And I'm looking at this stuff about electromagnetic pulse. And all of a sudden the Facebook starts to go bing, 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 bing. And I think it was a Bill Brockbrader. It might have been another group, but I think it could have been his. But anyway, you got these people, and all of a sudden they found out the dangers of electromagnetic energy. And I knew, like I say, a whole bunch of it because Vincent Collins had showed me this was how they're going to take over the world. So I was very, very cognizant. I had started a business trying to go into people's houses to help them, you know, I mean, but I finally had to give it all up because if you're telling people you're going to get killed with this stuff, but you don't have an antidote, All you're doing is inciting fear. So I had stopped. I came to that conclusion. I had stopped trying to push it. It was like, okay, but all of a sudden everybody's like talking about it. Well, meanwhile, I'm doing this thing on the EP, on the electromagnetic pulse, and I come across this at the same time. I mean, I'm on one window and the other window is Facebook doing this. And I come across this statement in a Russian document that, thank God, had been a Russian document translated into English, other than from Russian to German to English, from Russian to German to French to English. I mean, doing any kind of research that's, Russia is very difficult. But this was a Russian document. And it was talking about the electromagnetic pulse and how it could be neutralized by this stuff called shungite. Shungite. I don't know what it is. But meanwhile, ding, 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 ding. So I go over to the Facebook and I said, look up shungite. This will, help with electromagnetic problems. And then it stopped. The ding, ding, ding stopped. I went on, got doing my research and things. So the next day, I get back on the computer. Ding, 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 ding. Where do you find out about shungite? Where? Oh my God, they don't know what, I don't know what it is. So then I started researching shungite. And the more I researched, the more excited I got about it, because this might be the antidote that I could tell people how to protect themselves from electromagnetic energy. And this was a very important subject to me, because my brother Phil, who was a year younger than I, he was down visiting because he had business in the area. And we're on the beach, and he tells me, I knew that he worked for the Navy as a civilian, but I really never got into what he did because he wouldn't talk about it, very secret. And so I said to him, well, what are you doing down here? And he said, well, we're testing gravity. I said, you're testing gravity? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, what the hell do you do with the Navy? And he said, oh, I work with radars. Well, at that time, I knew how damaging radars were. There were many, many episodes of people working around radar that came up with a brain tumor. It was other things, but brain tumor was the big one. And I sat there, and he thinks I'm crazy anyway. So I said, eh, do I tell him? Do I not tell him? I said, I have to tell him because I have to tell him. So I told him the dangers of it, and he looked at me with this, he had this smirk on his face. He had the ability to put a smirk on his face that would just drive you nuts. It didn't say anything, just a smirk. And I told him the whole story, and that's what I got, the smirk. Well, it took quite a bit of time, like 20 years, but he got the same tumor in his brain and died. So I had that, it was, like real personal to me by that time. So once I started re researching the shungite, it was again another mission. Whoa, I got something I can help people with. And I threw all my energy into learning about shungite. And I also was on the radio on the two biggest stations in the world on different shows. And I was working very closely with JP, who produced the shows. And I started telling Jay about it. Well, Jay got researching it. He got all excited about it. And he said something to a group on another show that he was producing about this shungite. Well, in that group was a guy by the name of Walt Silva. And he hears what JP said. He listens to shows that we had done while I was relating what I had found. And then when JP really got into it, he had stories about what he was finding. And Walt got some of the shungite and proceeded to make an energy device that you could attach to your electric system, and it would you'd add shungite to the electric system. And by then I knew what it was doing. It was reversing the signal coming into the off of the telecommunications is rotating re in reversal of to our cells, the very cells in our body. So it's like two tops coming together, and the one that's more powerful is going to stop the rotation of the other one. And that's exactly what we were seeing. Once you put the shungite on, you don't see it. But before that, without shungite, you would have a we had a thermal testing to see what your hands and head look like before and after shungite. And if you just got the phone on, your hand that was perfectly okay, green, is all of a sudden turning red. The place where you got the phone is all red, Well, that's heat. And that's because the telephone was re constricting the way that your cells were actually rotating and causing heat and destruction of the cells. So we put the shungite near it, and all of a sudden, that's not happening. So he heard the, radio show, makes this device, and I come across it and I go, who the hell is this guy? So I get the contact information from JP on him, and I call him. And then we went on Skype and had conversation after conversation. What he brought to the subject of shungite was that I, by that time, was, highly developed energetically, being able to see things, feel things. Because remember, I'd been playing with this stuff since the 80s. So I would say to him, I'm seeing this, and he would be able to figure out a way of testing what I had said. So together we were able to give a real scientific foundation to the concept of how does shungite work? What's it do? And so this was 2014, the whole year 2014. Well, 2013 into 2014. And so by the May of 2014, I had enough shungite products that we had developed. We had, first off, just the nuggets itself. Second, we had pendants that we made out of the nuggets. And then we had created, we got powder, and we were able to create silver shungite. Now, that's simply that a pendant I had done for somebody that was silver coated. All of a sudden, I'm looking at it and I go, what's the matter with your pendant? All the silver had disappeared. And we were able to determine, because of testing that Walt put together, that silver will migrate into shungite. And actually, it's not just sitting there, it's not just coating, it integrates itself, saturates itself into the shungite. And I found out that using the silver with the shungite was much, well, shungite would affect electromagnetic, but when it came to the cell phone and Wi-Fi type of thing, it would change it, but not like I saw with the electromagnetic itself. So I knew that the Wi-Fi signal that was there was something that shungite could semi affect, but not really. But when the silver was added to the shungite, all of a sudden I could see that the Wi-Fi signal was also doing the same thing. So we had stickers that you could put on your phone with the silver saturated in it. And It changed everything. That's all I can say. It changed everything. I ended up writing a book, Shungite Reality. I highly recommend you take a look at it. Simply because you'll get a feeling for this whole story. If you're liking the way I present this, well, that book is semi the same as this, telling the whole story, detailing it out. So there we go. We're at 2014, and I started up the internet store. And because we had talked about it for so long, and I talked about, the things I had to go through to get the internet store up, that within 20 minutes of me making it live on the internet, I got my first order. So then it put me into an area where I became totally focused on selling and getting more information out about Shungite. And that was in 2014. So I don't even know how long we've gone here, but I'm going to end the show right here where we've introduced the concept of Shungite into the picture, because everything after that, in some way or another, was associated with Shungite. I stopped everything I did had Shungite involved in it. So I thank you very much for being here. I'm going to try to tape another one right after this. And I just so appreciate you going this journey with me. Have a great day, be safe, and I'll see you next time.
Say what? Say what radio show? With no agenda. It's always a surprise. But if we're not having fun, we're doing something wrong.